finish today, then I'll be here again in 2 weeks' time on the 8th to finish off. So that means that there's no, I don't have to rush it. Although, even though it looks long, the important parts are quite short, so there may be a chance to finish it in this one sitting. But it would be nice to be able to take in some of the other very interesting sutras, which are a bit longer. So that's why I can do them over 2 weeks, on times when I do successive sutra classes. So I think most people are in now, so if you have your sheet of paper with the sutra on it, it's called Digha Nikaya 29 Pasadika Sutta. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Okay, so this particular sutra, as you'll soon find out, was given in just the last few years of the Buddha's life. And it was stimulated by the news that the head of the Jains, in the Pali it's called Nigantha Nataputta, in today it was called Mahavira, of the Jains had just died. He was a contemporary of the Buddha, and many scholars think that at the time the Jains outnumbered the Buddhists, although we can never say for sure. But those were the two main religious teachings at that time. And so they were saying what happened after the Nigantha Nataputta died, and the Buddha was comparing it to his particular teaching. And there's one thing which you will see here was the importance for having a complete, perfected religion, he called it holy life, was the presence of bhikkhunis. So that's one thing I'm going to point out here, because that is still, for some weird reason, controversial. And it says here that it was part of his plan, and his holy life would not be perfected unless you had them. And also how to preserve the teachings was the second part of this sutta. And lastly, one of the main reasons I like this sutta is where it says about the monks, and by that he means the nuns as well, are devoted to a life of pleasure. And you'll find out what that means in a few seconds. So here we go. Thus have I heard, once the Lord was staying among the Sakyans, that's his family clan, at the school building in the mango grove belonging to the Vaidanya family. At that time, Nigantha Nataputta, Mahavira of the Jains, had just died at Parva. And at his death, the Niganthas were split into two parties, quarreling and disputing, fighting and attacking each other with wordy warfare. You don't understand this doctrine and discipline. I do. How could you understand this doctrine and discipline? Your way is all wrong. Mine is right. I am consistent. You aren't. You said last what you should have said first, and you said first what you should have said last. What you took so long to think up has been refuted. Your argument has been overthrown. You're defeated. Go on, save your doctrine. Get out of that if you can. So you see, things don't change. It sounds more like parliament than a religious discussion. You would have thought that Nigantha's, Nataputta's disciples were bent on killing each other. Even the white-robed lay followers were disgusted, displeased, and repelled when they saw that their doctrine and discipline, that means their religion if you like, their practice, was so ill-proclaimed, so unedifyingly displayed, and so ineffectual in calming the passions. That's a beautiful phrase, that, ineffectual in calming the passions, having been proclaimed by one not fully enlightened, and now with its leader gone without a referee. Now the novice Chunda, who had spent the rains at Parva, came to Samagama to see the Venerable Ananda. Having bowed to him, he sat down on one side and said, "Bhante, the Nigantha Nataputta has just died at Parva." And he related what had happened. The Venerable Ananda said, "Chunda, that is something that ought to be reported to the Buddha. Let us go and tell him." "Very good, sir," said Chunda. So they went to the Buddha and told him. He said, "Chunda, here," pointed Nigantus, "is a doctrine and discipline that is ill-proclaimed, unedifyingly displayed, and ineffectual in calming the passions, because its proclaimer was not fully enlightened. Such being the case, Chunda, a disciple cannot live according to that doctrine and maintain proper conduct, nor live by it, but deviates from it." To him one might say, "Friend, this is what you have received, and you had your opportunity, but your teacher is not fully enlightened. You cannot live according to that doctrine, but deviate from it." In this case, the teacher is to blame, the doctrine is to blame, but the pupil is praiseworthy, because he deviates from it. And if one were to say to that pupil, "Come now, Reverend Sir, and practice according to that doctrine proclaimed and given out by your teacher," then the one who urged this, the thing urged, and the one who so practiced would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill proclaimed. And you'll all notice in Pali they go through every combination here. So here we go from the other combination. There's two more to come after this. But here, Chunda, here is a teacher who is not fully enlightened, and a disciple lives according to that doctrine and conforms to it. In other words, he doesn't deviate from it. One might say to him, "Friend, what you have received is no good. Your opportunity is a poor one. Your teacher is not fully enlightened. His teaching is ill-proclaimed. But yet you continue to live according to it. In this case, the teacher, the doctrine, and the disciple are all to blame." And if anyone were to say, "Well, Reverend Sir, by following that system you will be successful," the one who promoted it, and the one who, on hearing such recommendation, should make still greater efforts in regard to it, would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill-proclaimed. Third of the combinations. But here now is a teacher who is fully enlightened. His doctrine is well-proclaimed, edifyingly displayed, effectual in calming the passions. We always see if the doctrine is properly proclaimed, you may argue with it, you may intellectually question it, but what you can find out if the doctrine is properly displayed, if it's a good display and the teacher is fully enlightened, it calms the passions, so you don't have big arguments afterwards. Effectual in calming the passions because of that enlightened teacher. But the disciple does not live up to that doctrine, but deviates from it. In that case, one might say to him, "Friend, you have failed. You have missed your opportunity. Your teacher was fully enlightened. His doctrine was well proclaimed. But you do not follow it and deviate from it." In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, but the pupil is to blame. And if anyone were to say, "Well, Reverend Sir, you should follow the teaching proclaimed by your teacher," then the one who urged this, that which was urged, and the one who so practiced, would all gain much merit. Why? Because the doctrine is well proclaimed. And just a word on this merit business. It doesn't mean like brownie points to go to heaven. It just means you're doing good stuff. As Paolo, who passed away a long time ago. Oh, is he still alive? But he described it anyway. He said, what merit means is a step towards enlightenment. Demerit is a step away. It's not just, you know, making generosity or giving food to monks and nuns. It also means that practice is making good merit, a step towards nirvana. That's merit. But now, Chunda, the fourth of these combinations, but now, Chunda, here is a teacher who is fully enlightened. His doctrine is well proclaimed. And the disciple, having taken it up, follows it, practices it properly, and keeps to it. Someone might say, "Friend, what you have received is good. Here is your opportunity, and you are following the doctrine of your teacher." In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, and the pupil is also praiseworthy. If anyone were to say to such a disciple, well, Reverend Sir, by following this that system, you will be successful than the one who thus commended it, and the one who, on hearing such commendation, should make still greater efforts, would all gain much merit. Why? Because that is so when the doctrine and disciple are well proclaimed, edifying and displayed, and effectual in calming the passions because of the fully enlightened teacher and supreme Buddha. So that's the first four. You can know whether it's a good teaching. Again, the difference here, which I'm pointing out, the bad teachings means it doesn't calm the passions, and people argue a lot, and they get upset, and they get angry. If it's a really good teaching, it should have the means to calm the disputes and passions. Otherwise, you know, it's very easy to have intellectual level. Much easier to. But now, the Buddha was comparing his teachings now. But now, Chunda, suppose a teacher has arisen in the world, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, and his doctrine is well proclaimed. It is effectual in calming the passions because of that teacher. But his disciples have not fully mastered that true Dhamma, and the full purity of the holy life has not become clear and evident to them in the experience of its unfolding, and has not been sufficiently grounded among them, being still in the course of being well proclaimed among humans at the time of the teacher's passing away from among them. In other words, great teacher, but doesn't live long enough to pass on the teachings. And that way, Chunda, the teacher's death would be a sad thing for his disciples. Why? They would think, our teacher arose in the world for us, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, whose doctrine was well proclaimed, but we did not fully master the true Dhamma, as long as it was well proclaimed among humans, and now our teacher has passed away from among us. That way the teacher's death would be a sad thing for his disciples. Now, number two. But suppose a teacher has arisen in the world, and his disciples have fully mastered the true Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has become clear and evident to them in the experience of its unfolding, and has been sufficiently grounded among them while being thus well proclaimed among humans by the time of the teachers passing from them. That way the teacher's death would not be a sad thing for his disciples. Why? They would think, our teacher arose in the world for us, and we have fully mastered the true Dhamma while it was thus proclaimed among humans, and now our teacher has passed away from among us. That way the teacher's death would not be a sad thing for his disciples. So it's only sad if either the teacher hasn't lived long enough to impart the Dhamma, or the students have been so thick and stupid and hard to teach that even though the teacher's lived a long time, they still don't understand what's going on. And then it would be sad. But if they've got the message, then it's not a sad thing. Now, this is the next little bit, starting from paragraph 10, and I'm just pointing out here, because of the controversy which still exists in many parts of the world, about the legitimacy of bhikkhunis, another passage here which shows how important their existence is to the Buddha. But Chunda, if the holy life is so circumstanced that there is no teacher who is senior, of long standing, long ordained, mature and advanced in seniority, then in such a case the holy life will be imperfect. But if such a teacher does exist, the holy life can be perfected in such a case. You need a senior teacher. Or in such a case, there is such a senior teacher, but there are no senior disciples amongst the bhikkhus, the monks, who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have attained peace from bondage. Another metaphor for being enlightened. Who are able to proclaim the true Dhamma, able to refute any opposing doctrines that may arise by means of the true Dhamma, and having done so, give a grounded exposition of Dhamma, then the holy life is not perfected. So don't need just a senior teacher, you need senior disciples who are enlightened and can teach. In such a case, if there are such senior teachers and such senior disciples, but there are no bhikkhus of middle standing with these qualities. Or despite the presence of these, no junior bhikkhus with these qualities. Or despite the presence of these, no senior disciples amongst the bhikkhunis. No middle ranking or junior bhikkhunis with these abilities. No white robe lay followers, male or female, celibate or otherwise. Or if the teaching does not prosper and flourish, is not widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide. Even if these conditions are fulfilled, if it has not got the first place in public support, then the holy life is not perfected. If, however, all these conditions are fulfilled, then the holy life is perfected. And now he compares his own religion at this time to show that Buddhism at the time just before the Buddha passed away was perfected. But Chunda, I have now arisen in the world, enlightened Buddha, the Dharma is well proclaimed. My disciples are proficient in the true Dharma. The full purity of the holy life has become clear and evident to them, folding. But now I am an aged teacher of long standing, who went forth a long time ago, and my life is coming to its close. However, there are senior teachers amongst the bhikkhus, who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have obtained peace from bondage, able to proclaim the true Dharma, able to refute by means of the Dharma any opposing doctrines that may arise, and having done so, give a grounded exposition of Dharma. And there are middle-ranking bhikkhunis who are disciplined and experienced. There are novices who are disciples. There are senior bhikkhunis, middle-ranking and novice bhikkhunis who are disciples. There are white robe lay followers, male and female, celibate and non-celibate. And the holy life I proclaim prospers and flourishes. It is widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide, well proclaimed amongst humans. So there he was just saying that why the difference between his group of disciples and Nikanta Nataputta, that you know, he had a large number of disciples who were fully enlightened, and it made, in his words, the Buddha's words, the holy life pure and complete. And only when, of course, he said, there were enlightened bhikkhunis. Otherwise, in black and white, the holy life is not complete. So anyway, to make it even more clear, the Buddha gives another simile in paragraph 16. Among all teachers now existing in the world, Chunda, I see none who has attained such a position of fame and following as I have. Of all the orders and groups in the world, I see none as famous and well followed as my Sangha of monks. If anyone were to refer to any holy life as being fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity, it is this holy life they will be describing. It was Uttaka Ramaputta, one of the teachers before the Buddha became enlightened, who used to say, he sees but does not see. What is it that, seeing, one does not see? And the answer, according to Uttaka Ramaputta, was, you can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge. That is what he meant by saying he sees but does not see. He spoke in reference to a low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a mere razor. But if one were to use the expression properly, he sees but does not see, it would be like this. What he sees is a holy way of life, which is fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity. If you were to deduct anything from it, thinking in this way it will be purer, you do not see it. And if you were to add anything to it, thinking in this way it will be more complete, then he does not see it. That is the meaning of the saying, he sees but does not see. Therefore, Chunda, if anyone were to refer to any holy way of life as being fully successful and perfect, it is this holy life that they will be describing. And that saying, he sees that there is it's pure, and he doesn't see anything which it is lacking or which is superfluous, that is one of the arguments we use as Theravada, if you say there were some other teachings which were hidden in the Naga world because monks and nuns at the time couldn't understand it, they were not intellectually sufficient. And it was brought out later on from the Naga realm when wise people could understand these things to add to the teachings of the Buddha. The Buddha said it was nothing to add, nothing to take away. So, you know, this was almost a perfection of the teachings. And to say that somehow or other you can add more to these Buddha's teachings to make them more perfect, namely like bodhisattvas and stuff, you say that goes totally against what is said over here. This, he said, there was nothing to add, nothing needed to be taken away. That's what he said here by, you know, he sees but does not see. He sees a perfect holy life, he doesn't see anything which needs to be added or anything which needs to be taken away. Anyway, the next paragraph. And this is how he wanted to make sure, the Buddha wanted to make sure that what was perfect, don't need to add, don't need to take away, would actually survive over many centuries. And as you know, should know, these teachings were never written down at the very beginning. Only 200 or 300 years later on did they start getting written down in Sri Lanka, in Dambulla. So the only way to preserve these teachings was to remember them. And that's why that monks and nuns would memorize these teachings, and the chanting which we do today always started off with just the monks or the nuns coming together just to practice the suttas they had memorized, to chant together. Because when you were chanting together, you would notice if you made a mistake, if there's any errors in your memory. And so this is actually, the chanting began as just a way of ensuring what you remembered was accurate. But later on it became to be used as ceremonies. In the early days, the chanting was just a way of preserving the teachings before things were written down. But this is actually how they had to remember them. It's paragraph 17. Therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that this holy life may continue and be established for a long time for the profit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world and the benefit, profit and happiness of devas and humans. Now, what are the things in particular you should recite? And these are called the 40 Bodhipakkhiyas. The four foundations of mindfulness, the four right goals. You may notice I took off the four right efforts, because I always find that effort thing actually is quite misleading. It's not really focusing on what you do, but just the goal of abandoning unwholesome things and establishing good things. It's the goal, the right goal. The four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factors of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things you should recite together. And thus you must train yourselves, being assembled in harmony and without dissension. If a fellow in the holy life quotes Dharma in the assembly, and you think he has either misunderstood the sense or expressed it wrongly, you should neither applaud nor reject it, but should say to him, "Friend, if you mean such and such, you should put it either like this or like that, which is the more appropriate. Or if you say such and such, you mean either this or that, which is the more appropriate." So this is when you think they made a mistake. You don't say, "Hey, mate, you're wrong." You actually do a bit more subtlety than that. If he replies, "This meaning is better expressed like this than like that, or the sense of this expression is rather than that," then his word should neither be rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning and expression. So don't disparage them. Take them aside and carefully explain the correct meaning and expression. Again, Chunda, if a fellow in the holy life quotes Dharma in the assembly and you think he has misunderstood the sense, though he has expressed it correctly, you should neither applaud nor reject, but should say to him, "Friends, these words can mean either this or that. Which sense is the most appropriate?" And if he replies, "They mean this," then his words should be neither rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning. And similarly, if you think he's got the right meaning, but express it wrongly. You should explain to him carefully the correct meaning and expression. But, Shunda, if you think he's got the right meaning and expressed it correctly, you should say, good. And the Pali there is sadhu. And should applaud and congratulate him, saying, we are lucky, we are most fortunate to find a new friend. A companion in the holy life is so well versed in both the meaning and the expression. So that's where the monks, when they meet together and do the chanting, they're supposed to make sure that everyone gets the meaning correctly. Now I'll pause for a minute, because that is actually almost halfway through. Well, we're doing well. Any questions so far before we go on to the next piece? Yeah. Ah.
And therefore, is the argument of the people who rejected the meaning when they see it like this, is it because they say, oh, well, what was added on here for?
No, actually, this, when it says that some parts of the suttas have been added on, monks like Venerable Ajahn Sujata and Ajahn Brahmani wrote a wonderful little book called The Authenticity Project. It's only available online because these monks don't want to sell it. I argue with them. You should put it in bookshops because that way it goes further around. But what they were doing is using many different arguments. Arguments such as the change in language, the change in structure, which happens over the decades and centuries, by which you can know for yourself what is an earlier text, what is a later text. I often give the simile, if you have a Harry Potter book and a Shakespeare play, you know, you don't need to be an expert to know which one was earlier, which one was later. You know, J.K. Rowling, you know, came a little bit later than William Shakespeare. That's quite obvious. And they use the same arguments to actually to date sutras and parts of sutras. The language is not the same. And so that's one argument. And they have many other arguments by comparing other recensions of the suttas, say in the Chinese. Because in the early days, these suttas were taken over to China. And when they were translated, because the Chinese is pictograms, it's really easy to actually to translate back again. And because of that, you can actually have a pretty good idea what the original version of the sutta was in Pali before it was translated. So it gives you another historical photo of what the sutta was like at that time. So in these arguments, there's many more. You can pretty accurately see what has been added, what hasn't been added. What's been added to the Pali sutras is very, very small. But no, some has been added. And it's wonderful to see the scholarship, which gives a very strong argument for that. But when it comes to bhikkhunis, not added. This particular sutta is pretty original. So the only reason why people argue about the bhikkhunis is not because there is a reason for it. So when it comes to the Vinaya, the monastic rules, which govern things like ordination, or comes to the suttas, which expose know what the Buddha really meant and what he wanted from his religious order, it's very clear that bhikkhunis are right central to it. It's only because they willfully don't want to look at it. They have the argument. Willful ignorance. Yes?
The nothing to be added, nothing to be subtracted. That's a pretty big criticism of fundamental Christianity. Yeah.
Indeed. What's the difference if instead of prescriptions for how you live and what you should do and on worldly arrangements such as with family or looking after children, this is something which is much more timeless than that, which is the nature of the human mind, the nature of things like craving, attachments. So where it's focused on is not how you live your life in the changing world, but on the inner world, which is in one sense independent. you can see that these monks, the Jains, arguing with wordy warfare, you think they may kill one another. Things like that haven't changed over so 2,500 years from India to Australia. So those sorts of things, the fundamentalism which causes problems, you know, in other religions, is not on the inner workings of the mind as much as like how you are ordered, commanded to take those out into your daily life. When it comes to daily life stuff, the Buddha doesn't say that much. 5 precepts, that's all. Which gives you a lot of leeway to adapt to different situations. This is a great question, thank you. Okay, yes, Wayne. Yeah. But you could actually say there was something to be added in the early days, the presence of bhikkhunis, of female monks. So yeah, it was good, people getting enlightened, but it wasn't good enough. It could still be improved by allowing the females into the sangha. Of individuals, yeah, but the holy life could still be subject to criticism, not perfected. And of course, in other places, I often quote, I don't know exactly the place because I'm getting old now, I don't remember just chapter and verse like I used to, but when the Buddha got enlightened under the Bodhi tree and Mara admitted at last, okay, you're enlightened, I give in, but please don't teach. You know, okay, one, getting enlightened is okay, but I don't want any more. And the Buddha said, no, I am not going to pass away yet. Until I have established, you know, this big community of monks, a big community of bhikkhunis, lay men, lay women, establish them in the Dharma. Until I've done the 4 assemblies, I'm not going to go away, I'm going to teach. And then just 3 months before the Buddha's Parinibbana, at the chapel of shrine in Vaisali, Mara came again and said, okay, you've done the deal now. You know, you've got lots of bhikkhunis, lots of bhikkhus, lots of white robe lay men, lay women followers. That was your promise, remember. Now you've got to keep it, time to go. We said, fair enough. So, it was, if like, the mission statement, is what we say these days, of the Buddha, before he passed away, to establish those 4 assemblies. So that's the other really strong argument, that was in the beginning of the Buddha's dispensations, we call it, his teaching career. That's what his aim was. That's why he was teaching. He said, nah, it's all done. And this is reflecting that as well. It was perfect in the sense his mission was complete. Yes, Annie? in translations of religious texts? Come on. You don't use ordinary English in religious texts. Yeah, it's well proclaimed, you know, it's a very general, it's the Suwakata, we say at the beginning of the quality of the Dhamma. But it's, you're saying, well, well spoken. I mean, it's clear, accurate, yeah, clear, accurate, easy to understand. Know the quality of someone who's a good speaker, who can take difficult concepts and explain it in a way that everyone can fully comprehend. And edifying means, you know, inspiring, uplifting. Yeah. Yes. Instead of edifying, yeah. Yeah. Bit cold, yeah. This was actually taken from Maurice Walsh's translation. I changed a few words, as you will find out later on. You notice that. But I didn't change many of them. But it's a good point that edifying is, you know, pretty sort of an old-fashioned word. When a good word, like inspiring. And is it... Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. It actually, you know, frying means to make like an eddy. And Eddie's not here today, so... So it literally means make like Eddie. Yeah, go on. Yeah, maybe. But inspiring is a much better word. Yeah, sorry. Okay. Oh, yeah. Get very disgusted. Yeah. Indeed, you are saying that in the time some of the texts were translated, that some of the comments by monks against women were very unedifying, not inspiring at all. And I think that was probably the case, that an all-male system would attract more than its fair share of misogynists, just by its very nature. It's a men's club. You know, just like, unfortunately, things like scouts, you know, I might get in trouble, this may take this off. Scouts might sort of attract... So don't get sued by the scout movement. So you can actually see that there was, you know, a great possibility that there'd be more misogynists, you know, in the all-male sangha, which is one of the other reasons why it's great is to have the bikunis in there, to actually to make it so it's not an all-male system. Yeah, go on. Oh, yeah, that's another thing. That's why it's great to be able to get... modern scholarship, and to put aside all your vested interests, what you want to believe, and just use cold, hard reason and good, strong evidence to use that it's a thing. The Christian Bible was 100% the word of the, you know, some of the disciples in the time of Jesus, and it actually proved that's wrong. And it was great step and great courage by scholars in the time when Christianity was incredibly strong in the West. But they managed to do that, and they formed what became known as the Enlightenment in Europe. So it can be done, and it's important to do that in all religions and find out exactly what was originally the word of the Buddha, what wasn't. And, you know, the hope is, and so far so good, that any misogynist statements are seen to be just added by other monks later on. I often notice that the people who do tend to become scholars, the ones who can't meditate very much. The higher, you know, I'd be in difficulty here again, generally speaking, a great generalization, wonderful scholars, but tend to be the ones who don't meditate very much, so they don't have the same understanding of the Buddha's teachings. And they're the ones who take control of the books and the translations and the publishing. That's my theory anyway. That's a good point. No, you don't find that in there, and that's, you know, because they maintain the bhikkhuni tradition all throughout the centuries. Maybe, you know, once the bhikkhunis are fully restored in Theravada, that stuff will disappear. It's a very good comment, thank you for that. Okay, let's get on. Okay, here we go. Number 22, verse 22. Chunda, I do not teach you a Dhamma for restraining the corruptions that arise in this present life. Corruptions are things like greed, hatred, and delusion. I do not teach a Dhamma merely for their destruction in future lives. but for one, for their restraining in this life as well as restraining in future lives. In other words, that you know, when one practices like this, like many people say, it's not going to just, oh, I didn't make it in this life and I'm going to start from square one in my next life. He says, what you practice in this life actually does have an effect in your future life. So you don't have to start from square one again. Accordingly, now we get to something which is very well known amongst the monastics, the reflections on the use of your four requisites. The four requisites for a monastic are the robes, alms food, lodging, and medicines. So we're supposed to do this, and many of us do this every day. Accordingly, Chunda, let the robe I have allowed you be simply for warding off the cold, warding off the heat, warding off the touch of gadfly, mosquito, wind, sun, and creeping things, just to protect your modesty. It should not be used as a fashion statement. It's not because, you know, you have to have this type of cloth or another type of cloth. You always remember, this is the reason we have this robe, nothing else. Let the alms food I have allowed you be just enough for the support and sustenance of the body, for keeping it unimpaired, for the furtherance of the whole life, with the thought, I shall eliminate the former feeling of hunger without giving rise to a new one of overeating. In that way, I shall live without fault and in comfort. So we always remember that one as well. Let the lodging, the hut, the cave, the room I've allowed you be simply for warding off the cold, for warding off the heat, for warding off the touch of gadfly, mosquito, wind, sun, and creeping things, just for allaying the perils of the season and for the enjoyment of seclusion. I always like that one. Because you have the huts, the houses, especially if you're in meditation retreat, for seclusion, to be by yourself. And also for warding off the heat and warding off the cold, so you are allowed to have an air con or a heater. Because that's the whole purpose, to ward off the heat, ward off the cold, so it's comfortable. And let the provision of medicines and the necessities for the treatment of sickness that I have allowed you be just for warding off feelings of sickness that have arisen and for the maintenance of health. These are the four requisites, and as a monk, anything else is regarded as totally extra, not necessary. These are the four basic requisites of life all the monk needs. Anything else is just, you know, extra. It may be, Chunda, the wanderers, oh, this is where I like. This is the main reason I'm teaching this sutta, because this is my favorite part. And very often I have to take this out and show it to people. The Buddha's words. It may be, Chunda, that wanderers of other sects, means other religious people, might say, the ascetics, the monks and nuns who follow the Sakyan, the Buddha, are addicted to a life attached to pleasure. I remember some of these Jains, they wouldn't stay in any houses. They'd be out there in the sun, in the cold. They would hardly eat, and they wouldn't overtake any medicines. They were really austere. Buddhist monks would often, nuns, would get the criticism that we were too soft, we were namby-pambies. The monks and nuns who are addicted to a life attached to pleasure. If so, they should be asked, what kind of a life attached to pleasure, friend? For such a life can take many different forms. There are, Chunda, four kinds of life attached to pleasure, which are low. And I just put in brackets there, hina. That's the word for low. Hina yana, which sometimes Mahayana say is Theravada. That is a very, very bad word. And it means to someone who follows a life attached to the following types of pleasure, which you will see in a few moments. Is low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble, and not conducive to welfare, not leading to revulsion, not fading away to cessation, to peace, to deep insight, to enlightenment, to extinguishment, nirvana. This is the four kinds of life attached to pleasure which are low. What are they? Firstly, a foolish person takes pleasure and delight in killing living beings, Secondly, someone takes pleasure and delight in taking what is not given. Third, they take pleasure and delight in telling lies. Fourthly, someone gives himself up to the indulgement and enjoyment of the pleasures of the five senses. These are the four kinds of life attached to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, not leading to revulsion, fading away, cessation, to peace, to deep insight, to extinguishment, to enlightenment, to extinguishment. So if anyone say, what is hina, jhana, the low way, you've just got the four things here. And it's interesting, it's not just the precepts, because people do break precepts. It doesn't mean a person who breaks precepts. It's a person who takes pleasure and delight in breaking these precepts. You know, enjoys doing things like fishing. Who enjoys stealing or cheating on your taxes. Who enjoys telling lies. Or most importantly, who gives themselves up to indulgence and enjoyment of the five sense pleasures. And it may be that those of other sects might say, are the followers of the Sakya, the Buddhist monks and nuns, attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking? They should be told no, for they would not be speaking correctly about you. They would be slandering you with false and untrue statements. But there are, Chunda, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive. I should mention the word revulsion. It's called nibbida. Nibbida is what you see, what the problem is, and you are turned away from it, repelled by it. Sometimes called revulsion, sometimes repulsion. The simile which the Buddha said, if you see like there's a sore on your leg, oozing pus, you wouldn't just be equanimous. Oh, look, there's a sore on my leg, oozing pus. No, you'd be repelled by it. It's a problem. You do something about it. It's a revulsion. It's not a negativity. It forces you to act, to let go, if you like, of the problems. To revulsion, there are these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to revulsion, to fading away of the problem, to cessation, to peace, to deep insight, that's abhinya, to enlightenment, to extinguishment, nirvana. What are they? This is where I enjoy myself. Firstly, a meditator being secluded from the five senses and secluded from the five hindrances enters and remains in the first jhana, which still has movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object of bliss. Filled with the delight and happiness generated by being totally free from the five senses. And with the subsiding of movement of mind onto the object and holding the object, by reaching confidence in letting go and singleness of perception, one enters and remains in the second jhana, which is without any movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object, filled with the delight and happiness generated by absolute stillness. Again, with the fading of delight, remaining imperturbable, mindful and clearly aware, one experiences in oneself that joy which the noble ones say, happy is the one who dwells with equanimity and mindfulness. One enters and remains in the third jhana. And again, having given up pleasure and pain, the bodily vedana, and with the disappearance of former gladness and sadness, the mental happiness and affliction, one enters and remains in the fourth jhana, which is beyond pleasure and pain, physical and mental, pure in equanimity and mindfulness, the four jhanas, with Ajahn Brahm's translation of them. These, the practice of the four jhanas, are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to revulsion away from the world, to fading away, to cessation, entirely conducive to peace, entirely conducive to deep insight, entirely conducive to enlightenment, entirely conducive to extinguishment, nirvana. So if wanderers from other sects should say the followers of the Sakya and the Buddhist monks and nuns are attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told, yes, we are, for they will be speaking correctly about you. They would not be slandering you with false or untrue statements. So if anyone comes up and says, Ajahn Brahm, you're attached to jhana, I say, yes. And they go, what? Is it attachment? it's going to get you into trouble. Then I read out the next paragraph. Then such wanderers might ask, well then, those who are attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking, how many fruits, how many benefits can they expect? And you should reply, they can expect four fruits and four benefits. What are they? The first is when a meditator, by the destruction of the three fetters, has become a stream winner, no more subject to rebirth in the lower worlds, firmly established, destined for full enlightenment. The second fruit or benefit is when a meditator, by the complete destruction of the three fetters and the reduction of greed, hatred, and delusion, has become a once returner, and having returned only once more to this world, will put an end to suffering. The third is when a meditator, by the complete destruction of the five lower fetters, will spontaneously arise after death in the pure abodes. Call it spontaneously arising instead of being born, because a born is like in a mother's womb, as a baby, and just have to grow up and go to school. This is where you spontaneously arise. You don't have to grow. You're fully mature as soon as you arise there. So spontaneously arise in after death in the pure abodes. And there they will reach extinguishment, nirvana, without ever returning from that world. And the fourth is when a meditator, by the destruction of the corruptions in this life, has by their own knowledge and realization attained to arahatship, to the deliverance of heart and the deliverance through wisdom. Such are the four fruits and the four benefits, namely the four stages of enlightenment, that one attached to these four forms of pleasure seeking can expect. So I love that, because that some people still keep saying, if you get jhanas, you'll get attached to them. Don't do them. Let them go. And that's not the way the Buddha taught. That's why I say this. Any questions about that? You've seen it here, you read it, don't make it up, you can check it. I did put my translation in for the jhanas, as you know, but the rest is just as it says in the Pali. But then such wanderers might say, ha ha ha, the doctrines of the Buddha's monks and nuns are not well founded. In other words, you're talking a lot of rubbish. They should be told, friend, the Lord who knows and sees has taught and proclaimed to his disciples principles which are not to be transgressed as long as life shall last. Just like a locking post or an iron post which is deep base, well placed, flat and unshakable. And these were part of the cities and towns in those days, put these stakes deep into the ground where they were supposed to be totally immovable. And deep base and shape. Immovable are these doctrines he has taught. And any monk who is an arahat, whose corruptions are destroyed, who has lived the life, done what has to be done, laid down the burden, gained the true goal, who has completely destroyed the fetter of not becoming, of being it should be, and is liberated by supreme insight, is incapable of doing nine things. This is a lovely thing about what is an arahat. So actually you can find out who's an arahat or not, who's a nine, because an arahat, it says here, is incapable of doing any one of these nine things. He is, or she is, could be either, incapable of deliberately taking the life of a living being. Incapable of taking what is not given so as to constitute theft. Incapable of sexual intercourse. Sometimes, it's amazing, sometimes people ask me this. Is an enlightened being, can they still have sex? It says here, no. He said, no, but. Well, he said, I'm just saying what it says here. He is incapable of telling a deliberate lie. This is another one I really love. Number five, incapable of storing up goods for sensual indulgence as he did formerly in the household life. They can't be an accumulator of lots of stuff. That was actually that time, just as an aside. When, you know, living with Ajahn Chah, he never did any of these other things, but I always wondered how much stuff he kept in his personal room. And he never let anyone go up there. Except once, must have been about a year before he passed away, I was hanging out outside his hut, and he said, Brahma Wang, so can you go and get something from my room? And I was so excited. The first time I go into my teacher's room and see what he had. And it was just one of those things, your heart just leaps when I remember it. You went in, there was nothing in there. There was a grass mat, a wooden pillow, and one robe on the line, and that was it. It was just so empty. And this was, you know, kings and generals, incredibly rich people were going to visit him every day, give him anything he wanted. But where he was, nothing there. Just like an empty room. And that was just so inspiring. And that's what it means, like someone who's enlightened, incapable of storing up goods for sensual indulgence as he did formerly in the household life. Incapable of acting wrongly through attachment, incapable of acting wrongly through hatred, incapable of acting wrongly through folly, incapable of acting wrongly through fear. These are the nine things which an arahat whose corruptions are destroyed cannot do. I'll pause there. Any questions about that? The nine things an arahat can do? Yeah. That's the trouble. Yes, it's part one of our rules. It's the eighth pajitya. If you want to know that one, have a look. And it says a monk, same for a nun, should not tell any lay person about their attainments, either in meditation or on the path, or any psychic power. Shouldn't show them off. And then you may say, why? Because number one, it does cause a two-class sangha. Now, those who are enlightened and those who aren't. And you all know that story if you've been around me long enough. First year in Wat Pa Phong. First month, actually, in Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. Food, disgusting. I've told you so many disgusting food stories. You know those. One day, waiting there in the dining room for the food to sort of just to come and pass it down. Wasn't that excited, the same old rotten stuff every week, every day. And a ute pickup truck came. And it drove really close by and it was full of pots of curry from the city. And as soon as I saw that, I'm sure many other monks felt the same. Yummy, today we're going to get a decent meal. You know, the sort of food you would get if you were sort of in Bangkok or somewhere. Instead of just the northeast, you know, grubs and snails and rotten fish. I thought, wow, great, I'm going to have a good meal today. And no, I was only a young monk, 23, 24, you know, you needed your food, you loved food, wasn't enlightened. So just really, wow, great. And then the driver came out of the cab and came in and said, where is Ajahn Chah? He's not here. And the senior monk says, no, he's gone to a house dana, to a blessing ceremony today. Oh, really? And so the guy went back into his car and drove off. That hurt. And the reason was, is because everyone thought Ajahn Chah was an arahat. You get much more bang for your bucks, much more merit giving food to an arahat than you do to an ordinary group of people. So because of that, he didn't want to give it to us, you know, riffraff. He wanted only to give it to the arahats. And now that is, I saw that myself and that hurt. That's why it's best never to tell who is enlightened and who isn't. Otherwise, you take a two-tier sangha. And the old joke is, you know that if you are streaming a once-returner, non-returner, arahat, you're called one of the Aryans. They call it Arya. And so if we have this two-tier system, we do create the aristocracy in Buddhism. Not the aristocracy, the aristocracy. And that causes all sorts of problems. So, you know, we really try to keep that quiet and keep it a secret. That's one of the reasons why. And I'm very much against people say, this monk's an arahat, this monk's isn't. Because what it does is just to get more gifts, using more money. And they use that, and that's really, really off. So it should be shared around for everybody, and don't know. Yeah.
With a lady from the Buddha, and
Yeah, indeed. So it's usually even as a layperson. If you do achieve anything, again, keep it quiet. This is Venerable Chi Kwang. She was born in Perth. She ordained in the Korean tradition. She's been here to give talks before. Many of you may know her. It was her master in Korea gave this wonderful piece of advice. She told this great, very elderly, wise Korean nun, told Chi Kwang, if you ever get enlightened, don't tell anybody. Because if you do, you'll have to spend the rest of your life proving it. It's a very wise piece of advice. If you go and tell someone you're a stream winner or you're enlightened, people will doubt you. It's called jealousy, unfortunately. But you don't have any choice. People will be looking at you, checking you out, and say, aha, I've checked you out, you're not enlightened. And it's just a pain in the neck. So that's what is said. And so the best thing is, if you are at any stage of enlightenment, just keep it to yourself. Maybe tell your teacher, but nothing else. And lastly, what happens? This is what happens to the Buddha's cousin, Devadatta. Because of any sort of so-called attainment, if it is, you make yourself out of it, you become proud. You become, I am a stream winner. I am much better than you. And it has all sorts of problems. That's what happened to Devadatta. It's very easy to get proud and to think this is an attainment rather than a letting go. And lastly, the story which I got from San Francisco about 18 months ago. You've heard this before. It's a very funny story. This was very big in Sri Lanka, of trying to, really wanted to become a stream winner, to be a soul one. Many Sri Lankans are desperate to become a stream winner. So there was a retreat held every year in Colombo, an enlightenment retreat, where meditation, teachings, and asking you questions afterwards to see what your understanding was. And the people running this retreat, after the, I think, 4 weeks or 6 weeks retreat, if they thought you had done something, they would actually confirm and they would give you a certificate to confirm that, yes, you were a soul one. And so it did happen. There was this really sweet old Sri Lankan woman, in her 60s or 70s. And they would always go to the temple and offer food to the monks or nuns. These really sweet old village girls. You know them. They're just so much faith. And she was visiting some of her relations over in Colombo. And they said, why don't we sponsor our auntie, our grandma, for this retreat? She's done so much good karma. She may actually get something. So they paid the money, and she very willingly went on this six-week enlightenment retreat. And at the end of the retreat, the organizers came up to her with a big smile on their face and says, auntie, grandma, we're so impressed with you. We have decided that you have qualified as a stream winner. And they gave her the certificate, the stream winner certificate. Congratulations, auntie. At which point the auntie got very angry, really upset. And they said, auntie, what's wrong? You're a stream winner. It's a course for great celebration. The first stage of enlightenment. This is a huge attainment. And she said, you don't remember me, do you? I was here 2 years ago and you gave me a non-returner certificate. You've demoted me. So that's the trouble with those things. And it didn't last much after that. So that's also because once you really start promoting this stuff, you get all those little scams like that. And it won't be long before you can right away, as long as you give enough donation to some place in the United States and you get a certificate of being enlightened in return post. Just like you can get degrees by return post. I'm sure that'll happen soon. Anyway, where are we going? Okay. The nine things which an arahant can't do. So 27. Or such wanderers might say, as regard past times, the ascetic Gotama displays boundless knowledge and insight, but not about the future, as to what it will be and how it will be. Does the Buddha prophesize? That would be, the Buddha replies, that would be to suppose that knowledge and insight about one thing are to be produced by knowledge and insight about something else, as fools imagine. As regard the past, the Buddha has knowledge of his past lives. He can remember as far back as he wishes. As for the future, the only thing the Buddha knows, this knowledge, born of enlightenment, arises in him. This is my last birth. There will be no more existence for me. That's as far as he can predict the future. And if the past refers to what is not factual, to fables, or to what is not of advantage, the Tathagata, the way the Buddha referred to himself, makes no reply. But if it refers to what is factual, not fabulous, but which is not of advantage, again the Tathagata makes no reply. But if the past refers to what is factual, not fabulous, and which is of advantage, then the Tathagata knows the right time to reply. The same applies to the future and the present. Therefore, Chunda, the Tathagata is called the one who declares the time, the fact, the advantage, the Dhamma, and the discipline. That's why he's called the Tathagata. Chunda, whatever in this world, with its devas and maras and brahmas, that's the whole cosmology, with its ascetics and brahmins in this world, its princes and people, whatever is seen by people, heard, sensed, cognized, whatever was ever achieved, sought after, or mentally pondered upon, all that has been fully understood by the Tathagata. That is why it's called Tathagata. Between the night in which the Tathagata gains supreme enlightenment, Chunda, and the night in which he attains extinguishment, Nirvana, without remainder, that's called Parinirvana, whatever he proclaims, says, or explains is so, not otherwise. That is why he's called Tathagata. It's actually the claim of infallibility, which is interesting. And of this world, with its devas and maras and brahmas, with its ascetics and brahmins, its princes and people, Tathagata is the unvanquished conqueror and seer and ruler of all. That is why he's called Tathagata. Now, on that, going back to our favorite subject of bhikkhunis, and what was added and what wasn't added. We all know that passage where Ananda asked the Buddha to ordain bhikkhunis, and the Buddha said, if we ordain bhikkhunis, the good Dhamma will only last 500 years, and no longer. And it was 500. Some people say 5,000. It's Panchasattva. It means 500. No way you can make it into 5,000. But the Dhamma is still alive today, 2,500 years. So the Buddha was wrong. But it says here the Buddha is infallible. It doesn't make mistakes like that. So what is the solution? Many people say, that is a strong argument that that passage was added. And he has arguments about that too. It says that's one place we can see it has to be added. Otherwise, you have to admit the Buddha made a big mistake. He was wrong. Sorry? Someone made a mistake there. If it wasn't the Buddha, then it's not part of the suttas. Problem solved. So anyway, let's finish to 29, so we're on to net 30. Yes. Oh, it's just what it says here. I'll read it again. Between the night in which the Tathagata gains supreme enlightenment and the night in which he attains Parinibbana, whatever he proclaims, says, or explains is so and not otherwise. Yeah. Yeah. And this was actually said during that time. So, that was just an example, another argument. Oh, yeah, he made mistakes beforehand. He got married, for example. That was a big mistake. Yeah, it's just between that time. The infallibility of that in that time, after enlightenment. Yeah. Exactly. Useful, yeah. Yeah, it doesn't make prophecies because it's not useful. But he did make that prophecy, and that's about the only prophecy which he ever made, which is really stands out. It really smells, as they say, but that's not what the Buddha said. Next one, the old argument. Or such wanderers might say, does the Tathagata persist after death? Now, you may see that I've changed the word. It's usually exist after death, but it's more accurate for the argument here to call persist. What was there before carries on. Does the Tathagata persist after death? Is that true? Another few foolish. They should be told, friend, this has not been revealed by the Buddha. Does the Tathagata not persist after death? Does he both persist and not persist after death? Does he neither persist nor not persist after death? They should be told, friend, this has not been revealed by the Buddha. And then they may say, why has the ascetic Gotama not revealed this? They should be told, friend, this is not conducive to the welfare or to the Dharma or to the holy life or to revulsion, to fading away, to cessation, to peace, to deep insight, to enlightenment, to extinguishment. That is why the Buddha has not revealed it. And that old saying, there's another sutta, the Sariputta sort of answered that one, and it's in the suttas, saying that there's no Tathagata to be seen now. So if there's nothing here at the beginning, then how can you say that what wasn't there at the beginning persists afterwards? But what the Buddha is saying over here is a simile of the man shot by the arrow. The most important thing is to get the arrow out first of all, rather than thinking out who shot it, what's going to happen after the arrow comes out, where's it going to go, and all that sort of stuff. So the Buddha was very clear here. There is an answer to that, but the Buddha said it would just create arguments, and so instead they may say, well, friend, what has the ascetic Gotama, the Buddha, revealed? They should be told the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering, has been declared by the Lord, the arising of suffering, the path leading to cessation of suffering, and the cessation of suffering. Got those two the wrong way around. Then they may say, why has this been declared by the Buddha? They should be told, friend, this is conducive to welfare, to Dhamma, to the higher holy life, to perfect revulsion, to fading away, to cessation, to peace, to deep insight, to enlightenment, to extinguishment. That is why the Lord has revealed it. Chunda, there's basis of speculation about the beginnings of things, which I have explained to you as they should be explained. Should I now explain to you as they should not be explained? And likewise about the future. What are the speculations about the past? There are ascetics and Brahmins who say and believe the essence of me and this universe are eternal. This is true and any other view is wrong. The essence of me and the universe are not eternal. The essence of me, this is like the self. So, yeah, but I call it the essence of me to make it a more interesting translation. The essence of me and the universe are both eternal and not eternal. The essence of me and the universe are neither eternal nor not. The essence of me and the universe are self-created. They are created by another. They are both self-created and created by another. They are neither self-created nor created by another, but have arisen by chance, and seemingly with regard to pleasure and pain. So it gets very complicated. When you realize there's no essence of me, then the problem is solved. Now, Chunda, I go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if, being asked, they confirm that they do hold such views, I do not admit their claims. Why not? Because, Chunda, different beings hold different opinions on such matters, so I don't get into argument. Nor do I consider such theories equal to my own, still less superior. I am superior in regard to the higher exposition. As for those bases of speculation about the beginning of things, which I have explained to you as they should be explained, why should I now explain to you as they should not be explained? And what about those speculations about the future? There are some ascetics and Brahmins who say the essence of me after death is material and healthy. The essence of me after death is immaterial and healthy. The essence of me after death is both. The essence of me after death is neither. The essence of me is conscious after death. The essence of me is unconscious after death, is both conscious and unconscious. The essence of me is neither conscious nor unconscious. Can you get your head around that? People in India, if you ever go to India and talk to people, they can get their head around such concepts very easy. So they think about that a lot. The essence of me perishes, is destroyed, ceases to be after death. This is true and any other view is erroneous. Now, Chundarai, go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if being asked, they confirm they do hold such views, I do not admit their claims. Why not? Because Chunda, different beings hold different opinions on such matters. Nor do I consider such theories equal to my own, still less superior. I am their superior in regard to the higher exposition. As for those bases of speculation about the future which I have explained to you as they should be explained, why should I explain them to you as they should be explained? So I understood, interpret all of those paragraphs, as that because different beings hold different opinions on such matters, they hold them quite firmly. So trying to get into an argument about these things is just unproductive. So the Buddha never teaches these things, he never teaches the opposite of those things, instead he just declares the Four Noble Truths. So including the path, so people can find out for themselves. So you don't get any solution by arguing. And because he said people hold, and hold is maybe the important word, different opinions on such matters. So argument is not going to come to any fruitful conclusion. But teaching Four Noble Truths does. And also, the last paragraph, but one, and Chunda, for the destruction of all such views. Not saying one is better than the other, from destroying all such views about the past and future. For transcending them, I have taught and laid down four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana. What are the four? Here Chunda, a monk, dwells contemplating the body, ardent, clearly aware and mindful, having restrained the five hindrances. Dwells contemplating feelings, mind, and then mind objects, ardent, clearly aware and mindful, having restrained the five hindrances. That is how Chunda, for the destruction of such views about the past and future, and for transcending them, I have taught the four foundations of mindfulness. As you know, that's my translation, but that's very accurate, according to the Pali and also to the commentaries, where it says, Loke Abhijito Manasang, sometimes people say, having abandoned grief and covetousness to the world, which is meaningless. You look there in the Pali and you look in the commentaries and it does mean having abandoned, or rather restrained, the five hindrances. And it's not body in the body, it's contemplating the body. Any Pali scholar knows that one. So, that is instead of arguing, four foundations of mindfulness to end all those speculative views. Any questions? Comments? Complaints? Yeah, go on. Oh, that one. Yeah. Well, it's when you compare that to everything else the Buddha said, as related in the sutras, especially what he said to Mara. You know, when the Mara asked him just to enter Parinibbana straight away and don't teach, and the Buddha said it was my goal to establish bhikkhunis. And when he reaffirmed that at the very end of the Chapala Shrine, as I said, when Mara said, you know, you've completed your task now, your mission is over, you've created bhikkhus and bhikkhunis and plenty of lay men and lay women disciples, therefore you can go. And what we said over here about a holy life only being pure when there are bhikkhunis, you'd see there is a great contradiction there. Why would the Buddha sort of promise that he's not going to die until he creates a bhikkhuni sangha, and then refuse bhikkhunis? So again, that whole passage is again very suspicious, because it has internal contradictions, and quite a few of them. If there's only one, then maybe you think maybe it's not such a big deal, but when there's several of them there, so it makes many people doubt the validity of that passage. So that's my opinion anyway. Yeah. Yeah. Again, people doubt whether that was true or not. But if it was true, the only argument which I can't second-guess the Buddha was that the culture of the time demanded that, and they would not get respect from the lay community. I know that many of the Buddhist rules seem to be a bit archaic, but they were there to satisfy the culture in which Buddhism started off in, to make it appropriate to that time and place. And that could be one reason that the Bhikkhuni Sangha would not get respect, would not be able to grow, unless it followed the social norms of the time. That's just a theory. Can't prove it, may be wrong. Okay. Well, there are some questions coming up, but I'll just do the last paragraph. And during this time, the Venerable Upawana was standing behind the Lord, fanning him, because it was very hot. Where's your fan? You should be fanning me. We got an aircon. And he said, "It is wonderful, Lord. It is marvelous. Lord, this exposition of Dhamma is delightful, highly delightful. Lord, what is the name of this discourse?" "Well, Upawana, you can remember it as the delightful discourse, the Prasadika Sutta." Thus the Lord spoke, and Venerable Upavana rejoiced and was delighted with the delightful discourse. That finishes it. Now, we do have some questions from overseas, because this is always streamed live. I hope they're easy questions, because it's getting a bit late. But we did finish it in one sitting, which is amazing. There's only two questions. Thank you. Many people... Well, this has nothing to do with this sutta. Many people quote Sutta Sanyutta Nikaya 45.2 to justify the importance of fellowship. How does one balance the need for seclusion versus socialization in one's practice? And also, what is a good schedule for lay people to make progress? And of course, this is the balance which you require, seclusion and service. I don't call it socialization, more service. And I can imagine the sutta you're talking about is the one where Ananda says, having good friends, Kalyana Mitta, is half of the holy life. And the Buddha says, no, it's the whole of the holy life, good friendship. Because that good friendship... You know, especially with other highly developed individuals or people also practicing, that encourages you. Many people say that when they go home and they practice by themselves, they fall asleep or they, well, it's a bit busy today, so I'm not going to meditate. But if you're in a group and you come every Saturday afternoon to do some meditation, because you come here, you have to meditate. And so that group support can be very, very helpful. So again, fellowship is very helpful. And sometimes there's only a few monk teachers around, nun teachers. And so sometimes it's hard to get access. So you can actually talk together and get some good advice from one another. Share your experiences and also motivate and support one another. So it's always a balance, seclusion versus socialization. But if all you ever do all day is socialize, and you know you never actually do any practice, then of course that is never working for you anyway. Ajahn Chah, similarly, he said, all your service, study, socialization, it's like the sweets, the dessert at the end of the meal. And the meditation is like the rice and curry, or the potatoes and mushy peas, if you like. So the main course is really important. If all you ever do is the sweets, study and socialize and talk about the Dhamma, if all you ever eat is sweets, you're going to get very sick. But if you balance it, have a good first course and a dessert of pudding afterwards, fine. Have it balanced. But if you only have a tiny first course and a huge serve of pudding, you know, only a little bit of meditation, a lot of discussion, you're going to get sick as well. So you have to have both. And a good schedule for lay people to make progress. When somebody asked me in Singapore many years ago, when is the best time to meditate and the worst time to meditate? I answered straight away, the best time to meditate is now, the worst time to meditate is later. One of those smart ass answers. But it's a good one. A good schedule for lay people to make progress is, again, it's you have your holidays, you have your weekends, so give meditation or study of suttas importance. And put it at the top of the list of things to do. So get your meditation out of the way first of all, and then do your other stuff. Because otherwise you spend, there's enough stuff you have to do in your house and at work. And if you want it to be, your house to be spick and span, perfect, you'll never have any time for meditation. So it's not having a schedule so much, it's actually giving importance to your meditation time. And lastly, that those people who think they don't have enough time to meditate, meditation makes time. It doesn't use time, it's an investment. If you meditate, your mind becomes clear afterwards, you can make decisions, get things done really quickly. Which means your meditation is not a spending of time, it's an investment of time. You get more time out of it than you spend. Okay, so thank you for those questions. I hope I answered them accurately. They weren't really based on the sutta, but nevertheless, good enough. So I hope you enjoyed that. It's a long sutta, an hour and a half, though we managed to get through it, which means I had to think of something else to do next in 2 weeks' time. I thought I was going to get an easy life, but there we go. So here we go. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now we do the arahang for the Buddha.
Cool. Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami.
Okay.